What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.
Hello, and welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm producer Faye Adabita. On the podcast for this episode, the story of one Volodymyr Zelensky, the journey of Ukraine's charismatic leader, from actor to president to war commander-in-chief, is well known. But how have the events of that conflict itself shaped a seemingly unlikely trajectory? Simon Schuster is the journalist and writer to tell that story. He's reported from Russia and Ukraine for over 17 years, mostly covering the region for Time magazine. His new book is The Showman, Inside the Invasion That Shook the World and Made a Leader of Volodymyr Zelensky. Joining Simon today to discuss the book is Carl Miller. Carl is co-founder of the Center for the Analysis of Social Media at Demos. He's an associate of the Imperial War Museum and author of The Death of the Gods, The New Global Power Grab. Let's hear more from Carl now.
Our guest today is Simon Schuster. His coverage of the war began in 2014 when he was the first foreign journalist to arrive in Crimea as Russian troops took over the peninsula. In 2019, Simon met and interviewed Volodymyr Zelensky himself for a profile for his presidential campaign, and he's continued covering his administration in the years that followed. When the full-scale invasion began the following year, Simon spent months embedded with the president's team, securing unparalleled access to their compound in Kiev, where he wrote his first book, which we'll be discussing the themes of today, The Showman. Simon, very warm welcome to you.
Thank you so much for that introduction, and thank you for having me.
Simon, take us into the day of the invasion itself for us to begin. Take us into Bankova Street, the president's compound, and what it was like in that moment as everyone kind of contemplated that thing that changed the world.
Well, the first thing that came through that morning, I think, and everything that the president, his team, the security guards, everything they were doing, it was clear just how unprepared they were for the invasion to take this form, to attack Kyiv first, to go straight for the presidential compound in the first hours of the invasion. So what you saw there on Bankova Street in the presidential offices, that is where President Zelensky went first thing in the morning. He got up out of bed after he was roused out of bed by phone calls and messages warning him and telling him that the invasion had started. He went straight to the office and he told his team to meet him there. The scene was, you know, very tense, somewhat chaotic. You had soldiers trying to barricade the doors in some cases with furniture, you know, chairs, riot shields, writing desks, whatever they had, because they really didn't have the material in place, quite literally, to prepare for what seemed to be the main risk at the time, which was Russian commandos breaking physically through the doors and trying to besiege the compound. That was the scene in those early hours as Zelensky tried to get his bearings, to see how much of his government, how many officials had defected and fled, who was still around, and to try to begin to lead and to begin to form a wartime administration.
That pivotal decision for Zelensky to not flee, to stay, against the good-natured urgings, I think, of many of his allies, wasn't it? Because he'd just been at Munich Security Conference and had actually been urged to stay there and form a government in exile. Had that decision in his mind, do you think, already been made as he turned up in Bankova Street that first morning? It was already determined that he would lead an administration that would refuse to flee in the face of the Russian assaults.
Yes, he had made up his mind about that quite clearly. The issue is he didn't expect for the invasion to take the form that it did. Like I said just a minute ago, you know, the Russians went straight for him. The expectation in his mind, and indeed in the minds of most of the military commanders that I spoke to, was a much more limited invasion escalation coming from the east, where Russia would try to chomp off some more pieces of Ukrainian territory in the industrial region there known as the Donbas. They didn't really expect, at least as the kind of most likely scenario, this full-scale invasion that would try to surround and besiege Kyiv in the first hours. So that is something you have to keep in mind when you think about, yes, he had decided not to flee, but the circumstances he was facing in those early hours were quite different to what he expected. And, you know, as one of his advisors told me, and I quote him in the book, there's really no way to calculate as you sit there and prepare scenarios for the war, scenarios for defensive actions. There's no way to calculate that one psychological factor. Will the leadership crack and run when faced with mortal threats to themselves, their families? And that was something that nobody knew. I think Zelensky surprised all of us by his decision very courageously to remain there despite the incredible threats to him and everyone around him.
So Simon, take us back for a bit then before we again approach the invasion itself. Tell us a bit about how you first met Zelensky and your first and early impressions of him as a man and at that point a presidential hopeful.
Yes, I met him in March 2019 when he was a few months into his presidential campaign. He was then already leading in the polls, in most polls. It was clear that he would be a very serious contender, maybe the front runner. So I told my editors, you know, hey, there's this comedian who seems to be pulling ahead in the elections in Ukraine. Maybe we should pay attention to this guy. And they said, yeah, go for it. You know, they saw it as a kind of amusing story for Inside the Magazine about a comedian running for president. So I profiled him then. I got in touch with his team. At the time, it was, you know, very easy to get access to Zelensky. They were not getting a lot of requests from international media back then, because nobody took him very seriously. I mean, I shouldn't say nobody, but broadly speaking, you know, he wasn't seen as kind of the man at the center of the world's attention by any means back then. So I got to know him for the first time during one of his comedy shows, which sort of doubled as a campaign rally. And I hung out with him and his comedy troupe. A lot of his friends were back there, you know, and they were kind of eating takeout, drinking, partying backstage, and then during the show. And then after the show, we went back to Zelensky's dressing room, just the two of us with a photographer to talk and take his portrait there. And the impression was, honestly, this guy ain't ready for what he's walking into. He was very naive, very optimistic, and very, you know, easygoing when it came to the very grave challenges that he was clearly about to face if he won the presidency. By that point, just to remind some of your listeners, Ukraine had already been at war for 5 years in the Donbas with the Russians. There had been a separatist war, ongoing for that long. So in some sense, Zelensky was a wartime president from his first day in office. And we talked about the fact that, hey, his life was about to get a lot less fun and a lot more difficult. My impression was that this guy is walking into a storm that he's not really... he doesn't know what he's getting himself into.
What do you think, when you interviewed him, was drawing him into politics? Because I was struck in your writing, Simon, about his earlier life, that this was not a man who was particularly political. He hadn't been involved in either of the two major revolutions, really, that had swept through Ukraine at that point.
No, he wasn't. Yeah, he stayed on the sidelines, partly of those two revolutions. So we're talking about the Orange Revolution in 2004, 2005. And then the Revolution of Dignity, or the Maidan Revolution in 2014. Both of those things, he sort of stayed on the sidelines. He didn't really participate. And from watching his comedy and his TV shows, it was difficult to guess whose side he was on politically. And part of the reason for that was financial. His television productions, his business and his show business, was reliant on both investors and partners in Russia and Ukraine. It had audiences, massive audiences, millions of people in both Russia and Ukraine. So he couldn't afford financially to alienate either one of those audiences. So that was certainly one reason. That changed very quickly after Russia took military steps against Ukraine during the first, what I would call the initial invasion in 2014, when Russia annexed Crimea and then moved troops and paramilitaries into eastern Ukraine to begin seizing more territory, sparking this really vicious war that began that late that spring and summer. At that point, Zelensky took a stand. And, you know, he began speaking out very vocally against the Russians and what they were doing. And he began winding down his businesses in Russia, which cost him about 85% of his revenue as a businessman, as a showman, as an entertainer. So that was a big hit, but he took it on principle because he said he couldn't, you know, stand the idea of taking the stage in Moscow with a smile on his face after what the Russians had done, stabbing Ukraine in the back by stealing this territory.
So he was greatly angered, almost like this latent Ukrainian patriotism or nationalism seemed like it was awoken a little bit after the seizure of Crimea. What happened next? I mean, was he already convinced that the political class in Ukraine was unable itself to resolve that conflict and that you almost needed this external force to come in to make progress?
I mean, I think psychologically, he was primed for that skepticism about the political elites through his comedy. First and foremost, he was always a political satirist. He knew politics. He knew the politicians because he needed to impersonate and make fun of them, to needle them, to point out their flaws and weaknesses. So yes, he had an abundant skepticism about the abilities of the political elites in Ukraine, the leaders of both revolutions, and generally every politician. That was just, you know, the way he thought about politics. He thought they were all crooks, more or less. You know, that comes through in his comedy for sure. So he thought he could do a better job. It wasn't difficult to convince him of this. You know, once that conversation really got going among his group of friends, you know, one quality that abides in him, despite the dramatic changes I saw over the course of my reporting and my acquaintance with him, one thing that is very consistent is confidence. That man believes in himself, sometimes to a fault. So when the conversations got going, and, you know, we can go into why this happened, but for various reasons, people started suggesting to him, hey, if you're so smart, why don't you run for office? You know, it wasn't difficult to convince him that he could do a better job.
And what explains, do you think, his kind of staggering electoral success thereafter? Because he kind of sweeps the boards, doesn't he? I mean, not quite the most kind of successful Ukrainian politician ever, but certainly someone who is able to convince lots of different parts of Ukraine that he's a better alternative than his opponents in that moment.
Yeah, the main reason, I'd say there are two reasons. One is the deep frustration and anger within Ukrainian society at their political elites at the time. There was an interesting survey published by Gallup. It was an international survey published during the presidential elections, then in the spring of 2019. And it found that Ukrainians had the lowest level of regard and trust in their government of any country in the world. 9% said they trusted their government. So I think, you know, Zelensky's standing as an outsider to politics. His positioning himself in the campaign as someone who's going to, you know, come in and whatever, drain the swamp, humble the elites, clean out the old stagnant ways of doing business in Ukrainian politics. That was very appealing. And also his campaign was very clever in that he didn't take any firm positions on the most divisive issues in Ukrainian politics at the time. He remained what one of his key campaign strategists described to me as a kind of blank slate. As he put it, a canvas onto which voters could project their ideas of the perfect president. So that helped. I think, you know, we have to talk about, you know, his TV show also, you know, that where he played the president on TV, a very likable and wonderful president. The president of our dreams, he was playing on television during the campaign. So that also had an impact.
And Simon, how is your relationship with Zelensky developing over this time? So you'd met him, you'd profiled him. Had you two clicked together? Like, how did he see you? You know, why then was he kind of, I suppose, like keen for you to play more of a kind of role in covering his administration after his election?
I don't know. Maybe I was more persistent. I wouldn't say him and I don't presume to know what was in his head. Some of his advisors told me, you know, in expressing surprise at how much he was willing to invite me around, some of his advisors were like, you know, yeah, they found this strange. And they related to me, basically, yeah, you know, he seems to like you. But that's kind of, you know, what I don't know what that means. I was persistent. I was covering the country very actively and intently, and I was interested in banging on the door to talk to him, to report on him and his administration well before it became the focus of international attention. That's just my job. I'm the Ukraine reporter. So I was interested in him, and I reported on his administration through, for example, the scandal that led to Donald Trump's first impeachment in 2019. You know, Zelensky was a major character in that whole scandal. And I was reporting it and observing it from Kyiv rather than the halls of Congress where the impeachment inquiry was going on. So that helped. I guess just persistence. I tried to always be around. I tried to always be as close as I could. So that put me, of course, in a fairly unique position when the invasion started to come to them, meaning Zelensky and his team, and say, you know, I want to write this book. And I wouldn't say that there was like a great deal of enthusiasm by any means about it. They are not book people generally. They're TV people. They're social media people. And especially at a time of war, they needed social media and television to reach their audiences very quickly with the messaging that they needed to deliver. Books are no good for that. They're very slow. So they were like, yeah, you know, if you want to write a book, go for it. We know you. You know, we've worked with you before. You seem like a good guy. You know, they'd seen my reporting. They'd read my articles, and yeah, it wasn't much more complicated than that.
And what were you trying to do with the book, Simon? Were you trying to kind of capture? It almost reads like this kind of authoritative, the historical record of that moment. Like you're the person that's in there, and you see what's going on, you speak to everyone that seems to matter, and it's almost like you just want to capture and solidify that moment, you know, before it's gone, so that one day, perhaps when we all have slightly more breath and time, we can go back and reflect more sagely on what happened then.
Thank you. That's my sincere hope. So the goal of the book was never to analyze or pass judgment or criticize or endorse. It was to chronicle, to record what was happening and how we got here. So it's not only the kind of first months, the first year roughly of the invasion, but also the years leading up to it and all of these kind of tectonic shifts politically, geopolitically that led up to the invasion. So to record those events, to kind of capture what was happening before the story settled into a set of narratives, maybe propagandistic narratives, as often happens in wartime. So I was there in the moment in real time for many of the events described in the book during the invasion, talking to people before they really agreed amongst themselves, okay, this is how we're going to talk about this in the future. That often happens. So the book records very fresh accounts of what was going on, often, you know, literally in the moment as these events are unfolding. I'm talking to the participants and telling them, you know, how are you feeling? How are you responding? How are you thinking about this? And so on. So I think that, I hope, will be a valuable record and a revealing one for the public understanding of the war now and in years to come. That was the goal.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Tell us a bit, Simon, about the evolution beyond the initial days of the invasion in Bankova Street. So take us into the kind of diplomatic blitz that Zelensky then gets on. Because it also seems that you think that that was a moment when a different kind of president might really have failed to kind of rally the West in the way that Zelensky was able to do and secure the kind of support that he was able to secure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, insofar as the book presents an argument, I'd say that that's one that I think that the evidence events certainly stand that up, that his skills as a showman, as an entertainer, as someone who could really capture the attention of his audience, and in this case, his audience was all of us, the entire world. Those skills proved instrumental to his success as a wartime leader and indeed Ukraine's survival. I describe in some detail in the book how this strategy, his approach to doing this, to grabbing our attention, to shaping the narrative. You know, there's a lot of detail in the book about how they thought about these things. Some of the conversations, to a surprising, to me, surprising extent, used the vocabulary of script writing or movie making. So the way that they talked about presenting the story of this war and making the world see the picture of the war that they wanted the world to see. They needed the world to see to maintain sympathy, to maintain support, and to keep those weapons flowing into Ukraine. You know, those things were connected in their minds. And Zelensky saw it, I think, certainly early in the invasion as his primary mission to keep the world on his side and to convince them that this wasn't, you know, just some pity case at the edges of Europe. This was a conflict, a crisis, a war for their own values in the West, for all of our values, to make the world experience, at least the democratic world, experience this war as their own. That was the message. It's a very difficult message to drive home, but he was very successful in his communications. And I think one particular thing that he did that I think would have been much more difficult for another kind of leader, maybe a more traditional politician or diplomat, was that he didn't communicate only with his counterparts in foreign countries in the West through, you know, secure line telephone calls, you know, Mr. President, right? He was communicating directly to the people who elected those leaders through, you know, he spoke at the Grammy Awards. He would speak via video link at these massive rallies across Europe. You know, he was everywhere. He took every opportunity not only to speak to his counterparts, but to speak to the people who elected. That was a very powerful means of persuasion that he used to extraordinary effect in keeping the world on his side.
And this kind of interplay of both things which remain elemental and continuous and constant in Zelensky, the ability to communicate, the amazing showmanship, the lean towards media and the press. Like it really fascinatingly interplays, doesn't it, with also how Zelensky has changed and that arc of his evolution from naive comedian through to, well, I don't know how you would describe him now, Simon, battle-hardened war leader. Tell us a bit about that evolution and how that's happened, because it does sound, at moments at least, like Zelensky has become more cynical and actually more ready to use political power and the enormous powers he has as a martial law president in ways that once he would probably have satirized and criticized himself.
Yeah, I mean, a lot to unpack in that question. So his transformation has been stark. I've said before that I think he's difficult to recognize, even if you compare the person who was elected in 2019 to the leader we have today in Ukraine. In one of the photographs I included in the book, or it's a pair of photographs that shows you his portrait the day we met during his presidential campaign, 2 months before he was elected, and then our first interview during the invasion. And you see, you know, a couple months into the invasion, and I mean, it's a different face. He's aged. It looks like he's aged, I don't know, 10 years or something.
Yeah, it's astonishing.
Only a few years have gone by, and you know, he talks openly about this. He's like, he admits I'm changing. He's growing a much thicker skin. He's becoming tougher. You know, less patient, much less time with his aides for banter and small talk and jokes and these kinds of things. Now it's really all business. He's very single-minded, very focused, and he wears this kind of invisible armor that gives you the sense that you know, this guy is made of metal. That was never. I mean, nothing like that existed around him. So it's almost like. You know, he's come to embody this persona of the wartime leader that he had in his mind. You know, in those early days of the invasion, he imagined what is a wartime leader supposed to do in a situation like this. And he, in part, I think, because of his skills as an actor, you know, really was able to morph into that role more completely and more quickly than the average Joe would have.
You also write that his kind of inner circle has shrunk and kind of has been divested of the kind of childhood friends that that once would have told him he was completely wrong. Just tell us a bit about that, because I think that seems like such an important factor in decision making often, and it's barely something that we can often see as the public. But but it was something, of course, that with the amazing access you had, you could actually watch firsthand.
Yeah, well, you know, when you spend that much time there, you see people falling away, you see people getting pushed out of the inner circle, other people coming in, you know, these kinds of shifts. They're very inside baseball, but they're very important to understanding the dynamics within the leadership. So it's something I observed very closely. So yeah, I think as a general tendency, yes, over the course of his presidency, the circle around him, the circle of advisors, has shrunk dramatically. In the beginning, it was a very big and somewhat chaotic circle, where with people, with advisors and kind of hangers on and people from the movie business and the tech industry, and, like, you know, people from all walks of life kind of hanging around the presidential compound, formally or informally advising the president and so on. Now it's a very tight, fairly disciplined circle around him. I would say the people who would contradict him or question his instincts, question decisions that he had made in his gut already, people who would try to dissuade him, those people, as a rule, and I'm generalizing here, but as a rule, found themselves pushed to the side. He doesn't do well with that kind of second guessing in his circle. So I wouldn't say that he's surrounded by yes men, you know, by any means. You know, the people around him still present him with you know, a full picture of the world, of the war, of the diplomacy. But he does, you know, have a tighter circle around him. I think one trap that leaders often fall into, you know, if you look at history in that situation, when you become more isolated, your access to information suffers. You have more limited sources of information, and you have to really trust your advisors to bring you accurate information. Zelensky has an interesting mechanism that I observed for checking what he's being told by senior aides and officials. He travels a lot. He travels to the front, and he travels to foreign countries. He travels around the country, and he talks to people, regular people, soldiers, you know, grandmas, pensioners, whatever. And he listens to them. He really, you know, it's interesting to observe. He really asks them, like, what do you think is going on? What's your experience of the war? How is your weapon system working here at the front? Is it good? Does it work? Are there any problems I need to know about? And he takes that on board. And from what I observed in traveling around with him, that is his kind of mechanism for making sure that his information is clean, that he's getting from his top aides. And if he learns that information is not sound, those aides will hear about it.
Now, the book is packed full of other interviews, of course, as well, not just Zelensky, but the First Lady, Alina Zelenska, and opposition politicians and others. There's one, Simon, that I'd like you to briefly introduce us to, and that's perhaps the second most powerful man in Ukraine, the commander-in-chief of the Ukrainian armed forces, Zeluzhny. Because, I mean, I think I always seen him as this kind of quite grimacing, hard-looking, faintly scary man. But but the portrait that you painted of him was actually as a kind of slightly more fragile trickster, but certainly a much more human person. Yeah. And quite an unlikely commander-in-chief as well. So could you just tell us a bit about meeting him and what he was like?
Yeah, he's also very, very charismatic, warm, human. I'd met a fair number of generals over the years, including General Zeluzhny's immediate predecessor. Most of them came from the Soviet school of military discipline. They were kind of ramrod posture, fairly stiff. Zeluzhny is of a different generation. He never served in the Soviet military, in the Red Army. He's too young for that. He grew up in independent Ukraine, and his personality is just very different. He's very open, communicative, engaging, fun to be around. He told me in one of our in our main kind of conversation, our interview, that he wanted to be a comedian like Zelensky when he was growing up, and his military career didn't leave him enough time to pursue his talents for comedy. I try to paint him as three-dimensionally as possible, you know, in large part because he shed so much light on the main figure in the book, Zelensky. But also because understanding Zeluzhny is critical to understanding the war and where it's going. So that relationship really runs through the book. You see it evolve from its earliest days until the point when there began to be some serious tension between the two men.
And is that tension alive and well today? Is this something that you see kind of getting worse, the kind of relationship between Zeluzhny and Zelensky?
It's alive today, yeah. The relationship is tense, yes. You know, what you see, you know, in the book, and this is played out since I finished the book, you know, is that over time, you know, in the beginning of the invasion, Zelensky wholeheartedly trusted the generals to do the fighting and didn't much get involved in their battlefield decisions. He would ask them, what do you need? How can I support you? Give me the list of weapons you need so that I can then go banging on doors in every capital in the West and try to get those weapons for you. That was kind of the synergy in the relationship between the president's office and the military command. Over time, what I saw is President Zelensky grew more confident in his own decision-making as a military leader, his own ideas of what needed to happen on the battlefield, his own military priorities. Those didn't always align with those of the generals, and they began to have disagreements. Under the Constitution of Ukraine, Zelensky is the supreme commander in chief. So there were occasions, including on very, very important military decisions, where he pulled rank and overruled General Zeluzhny and other commanders and told them what to do, told them where to attack, where not to attack, when to attack, how to use military resources, right? So that's sort of an evolution in Zelensky that you see over the course of the book. He steps into his own also as a military leader and strategist.
Simon, my last question is about the future. I'm interested in knowing what you think the main challenges are for Zelensky now, and whether it is this one which kind of seems to rear its head more and more towards the end of the book, which is keeping Ukraine and himself, I suppose, in a way, in the spotlight, keeping the world's attention there, and really whether you think that is the main challenge for Ukraine and Zelensky now, and whether you have a sense of how Zelensky is going to kind of strategically try and confront that challenge across the rest of the year.
That's one big challenge. I wouldn't say it's the biggest one. I'd say his biggest challenge these days in terms of communication is inspiring young men and women in Ukraine to volunteer to serve in the military. There's a real serious problem with recruitment. They don't have the men. They don't have the numbers to fight, to continue fighting the way that they have been. So that's problem number one. In terms of winning and maintaining the support and the hearts and minds of people in the West, they're always looking for what Zelensky calls a new move, you know, meaning kind of a new twist, a new dramatic picture to show that Ukraine is winning. He takes enormous heart from these kinds of very dramatic attacks that we've seen, especially in recent days, of exploding fuel depots and oil terminals inside Russia. You know, this is very, these are very dramatic, visually attacks, and they remind the world that Ukraine is pushing on. Ukraine is in this fight, and it's not giving up. So that's the message that he's going to continue delivering, and I would expect much more along those lines in terms of the fighting, the battlefield. Zelensky started using this phrase "active defense." That is what he means primarily. He means yes, there is something that looks like a stalemate along the physical front line, the trenches in southern and eastern Ukraine, but in other theaters of this war, including the Black Sea and including Russian territory, Crimea, it's very dynamic, and the Ukrainians are using a lot of their own weapons, homemade weapons. Drones, missiles, and other weaponry to keep the Russians on the back foot, to keep attacking. So I think I very much expect that to continue in the coming months.
Well, Simon, thank you so much for this fascinating discussion, and thank you even more for what is, I think, a kind of really spectacular, brilliant book. For those of you listening, it's called The Showman, The Inside Story of the Invasion That Shook the World and Made a Leader of Volodymyr Zelensky, and it's available now from your local bookshop. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Carl Miller, and you've been listening to Intelligence Squared.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Connor Boyle and edited by Tom Hall. And if you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. And members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.